Thanks, Tony, for that kind introduction. I'd first like to acknowledge my co-author and colleague, George O'Connor from the University of Florida, and he has contributed immensely to understanding the mechanisms associated with the binding of phosphorus by water treatment residuals. He'll also be answering the questions at the end of the presentation. No, on second thought, George will probably be asking questions at the end of the presentation. A number of industrial municipal byproducts can be used for binding phosphorus and controlling P loss. They must be cheap and easy to obtain, environmentally benign, and efficient in P sequestration. And water treatment residuals really fit the bill, and I hope to prove that to you. So the roadmap for the presentation is to talk about the types and characteristics of water treatment residuals, look at some of the mechanisms associated with P fixation by WTRs, some of the strategies and the ways that these are used for reducing P loss, and then some of the implementation issues that need to be overcome. In terms of types and characteristics, water treatment residuals are produced in the process of taking a raw water source, whether it be a lake, a reservoir, a river, all the way down to finished drinking water. These processes, although they can be variable, tend to have two major components: one, flocculation, sedimentation, as well as sand filtration. And water treatment residuals really originate from those two processes, either the sedimentation basin or the filter backwash. The key is that it's important to understand that WTRs and their composition really reflect the signature of the raw water as well as treatment chemicals that are added in the process. So two major types are the coagulation flocculation WTRs, which I just showed you a flow schematic. And these can be either what I'm going to designate as AL-WTR or aluminum water treatment residuals, or iron-based water treatment residuals. Most treatment plants in the U.S. anyway use alum, but ferric chloride or ferric sulfate can be used. The other major type is really from water softening processes, that is, treatment plants that are designed just to reduce the hardness of the water. And these produce a high pH material that's really been used as a lime substitute. I'm going to focus really on the aluminum water treatment residuals because I think most research has been done on those, and alum being the most common coagulant, as well as the fact that serendipitously the next presentation is going to talk about iron binding or phosphorus binding to iron oxides. So the purpose of alum in water treatment is really to destabilize negatively charged colloidal particles, the sediment or bacteria, whatever happens to be in the raw water source. Typically, they do it by two processes. One, either charge neutralization, which is a low alum dosage, or the second is to sort of put enough alum in there to cause precipitation of aluminum hydroxide, and it's called a sweep flock. Basically, the settling aluminum hydroxide captures the sediment particles as it's settling, and then those are removed. The point is that you can have a wide range of alum dosages used in water treatment, and as a result, the P binding capacity can be very variable. So besides the precipitated hydroxide, the materials, water treatment residuals contain those materials from the raw water, sediment bacteria, dissolved constituents, as well as materials and chemicals that are added during treatment and storage. In terms of the overall gross characteristics, they tend to be circumneutral in pH. And maybe the other thing to note is they have a fairly low nutrient value. Not negligible, but typically the total nitrogen is less than 1% and the total phosphorus less than 0.5%. We were actually quite surprised when we saw that water treatment residuals had any nitrogen content, but again, it reflects the raw water. They also use chloramine sometimes in chlorination, and as well as some of the polymers they use are polyacrylamide, so that probably accounts for some of the nitrogen content of water treatment residuals. Also, in terms of the major elements, very variable depending on the chemicals that are added. In terms of trace elements, water treatment residuals are perhaps not remarkable in terms of comparisons to soils, with some exceptions. And I point out that copper can be high in water treatment residuals because copper sulfate is often used as an algicide in the raw water source. In the past, we've also seen high trace elements in iron-based water treatment residuals, where the coagulant was actually produced as a byproduct of waste pickle liquor in the steel industry. So, but in general, the trace element levels in water treatment residuals is not dramatically different than some soils. And I'll mention the arsenic later on in the presentation. In terms of why these materials fix phosphorus, well, often when you precipitate, say, aluminum hydroxide in oversaturated conditions, you produce X-ray amorphous aluminum hydrous oxides, and these tend to be very retentive and have a high binding capacity for phosphorus and other oxyanions. They also tend to have a high zero point of charge, meaning that at near neutral pH conditions, the water treatment residuals carry a net positive charge, and of course, phosphorus being an anion, there tends to be electrostatic attraction. The other issue is that they have a very high specific surface area, often because they are microporous. So there's not only external binding sites, but also internal binding sites. These are some batch studies, actually from Nick Basta. I see him here in the audience, where basically a number of water treatment residuals were put in contact with soluble phosphorus and you see a removal of the phosphorus from the water. A couple of noteworthy features. You often see sort of a two-phase kinetics where you get this rapid initial adsorption, probably due to surface reactions, and then you have this long tail that's often associated with diffusive penetration into the WTR particles. And the other thing to point out is that WTRs can be quite variable in their p-sorbing capacity. In terms of the nature of that p-fixation process, scanning electron microscopy and electron microprobe analysis suggests that it's really an adsorption reaction and not so much a surface precipitation. And again, this diffusive penetration into the WTR particles has a lot to do with sort of the long-term adsorption phase. If you're trying to get a handle and quantify the p-sorbing capacity of a WTR, oxalate extractable iron or aluminum is a great way, a quick way to do it, because it's generally considered that the oxalate extraction procedure extracts the X-ray amorphous hydrous oxides. And so this just shows the Pmax from isotherms as a function of the oxalate extractable aluminum content in a number of aluminum-based water treatment residuals. But if you want a more precise measure of the ultimate p-sorbing capacity, probably involves really long-term studies as well as characterizing the pores and their ability to bind phosphorus and the accessibility of these pores to the phosphate. Some of the P removal strategies that are used, typically three strategies are used. You'll hear about some of those in subsequent presentations, but blending or co-application of the WTRs with the phosphorus sources, incorporation into soils that have a high P from manure or biosolids application, and then using these to intercept phosphorus in surface or groundwater flows. The basis of the blending is the well-known fact that the water extractable phosphorus, and here is shown as the percent of the total phosphorus, is inversely related to the iron and aluminum content of different P sources. So this is just a number of different P sources, and you see as you increase the iron and aluminum content, you reduce the water extractable phosphorus or the environmentally relevant phosphorus. One data point I just wanted to point out here is this point happens to be the Philadelphia biosolids that contain water treatment residuals. Philadelphia has three major water treatment plants that all use ferric chloride. those water treatment residuals are put in the sanitary sewer, and they end up basically being processed with the sewage sludge at the wastewater treatment plant. So there's a case where you have a municipality that's producing water treatment residuals, but they're really not available for, say, P loss reduction. This is a field study from Florida showing the fact that water treatment residuals can be co-applied with nutrient sources based either on an N-base or P-based basis, and basically control the phosphorus content of shallow groundwater. And you can see the control over on the far right. And the idea is that basically with the addition of water treatment residuals, you can keep the phosphorus in the shallow groundwater no higher than the control, even with N-based applications of nutrient source. I mentioned the fact that you can take the soils that have been impacted and add water treatment residuals. And so this was a manure impacted soil, the malic being about 900 parts per million. Was mixed. These are the column study where the soil was mixed with water treatment residuals at different rates, and then leached over, I think it was a 36-hour leaching period. And basically, you find out that you get dramatic reduction in the amount of phosphorus leached from this manure-impacted soil. You can use water treatment residuals in buffer strips. Again, this is some work from Nick Bosta's group showing, it was actually a simulation, a rainfall simulation where box plots, which were grassed, had soil and grass growing on them. The upper three quarters of the box had poultry manure surface applied, and the lower quarter was the buffer strip. And so these different water treatment residuals applied in the buffer strip reduce the soluble P relative to, say, the unamended buffer strip. One thing I wanted to note there is you have to ensure that there's good contact when you apply these materials in the buffer strip. We did some research and we found out that at least under sheet flow conditions, it turned out that there wasn't adequate contact time of the flowing water with the water treatment residual to get a significant P reduction. And then, of course, if sheet flow actually transitions into channel flow, you tend to bypass some of the renovative capacity of that buffer. So those are just a couple of cautions there. Interception of leachate P. This is a study where this was a column study that had grass growing on the surface of the columns, and we used TS triple superphosphate as the P source, and we amended the columns with different kinds of water treatment residuals. And this column here shows a comparison of the applied P leached over a 4-month period relative with the water treatment residuals relative to the unamended columns with the TSP only. You'll see the aluminum water treatment residual had a dramatic impact on reducing the leachable P. The other interesting thing to note is that the hematite had basically no impact. And that hematite was put on at the same total iron content as the iron water treatment residual, again underscoring the point that crystalline oxides are not very effective at absorbing P relative to X-ray amorphous materials. Water treatment materials residuals can be used in these permeable reactive barriers. They're basically designed to intercept flow, contaminated plumes, and so something is put in, the material is used to either detoxify or immobilize the pollutant. You tend to see these most often for industrially contaminated plumes. They use zero valent ion in the barrier, and often used for reductive dechlorination of organic materials. But you can, in fact, use water treatment residuals, and in such a way that this is to intercept shallow groundwater before it reaches some ditches. And of course, a key point would be that the hydraulic conductivity of the barrier needs to be higher than the conductivity of the surrounding soil medium. Some of the implementation issues. How much should we apply? Well, if you're blending, it depends really on how we're going to use it, but if you're blending it, you can mix the material to some target water extractable p-value. If it's being broadcast in buffer strips, you could just need to ensure that there's excess p-sorption capacity and, as I mentioned, sufficient contact opportunity with the p-laden runoff. If it's going to be incorporated into high p soils, you need to do two things. You need to ensure that you're reducing the environmental losses, but also you want to be certain that there's adequate phosphorus for the crops. And it's kind of a familiar picture, but where you can, the idea is you're looking at the runoff dissolved phosphorus as a function of the soil test P, and you know there's some environmental threshold at which that increases dramatically. So ideally, what you want to do with your water treatment residual is move, you know, from the high end somewhere down into this area, hopefully without inducing a phosphorus deficiency in the crop. And that typically can be done if the application rates aren't excessive. Here's a study, a field study, where water treatment residuals were used in conjunction with nutrient sources. The important point being that the dry matter yields are not significantly different. You can, in fact, see a reduction in the uptake of phosphorus, but in this particular case, it was different, but it wasn't below some, you know, critical threshold where you actually say induced a phosphorus deficiency, because the yields were unaffected. Another big issue, and it's always often asked, is the bound pea stable long term? Will that phosphorus come back off? And this was an incubation study. You see it done for 4.5 years, where basically the solid bars are the pea sources that don't have any water treatment residuals, and the others, the crosshatch bars, are with a water treatment residual. And at different pHs, 3, 4, and 7. And the real take-home point is here, even after 4.5 years, when you have the water treatment residuals, the phosphorus is not easily released. Now you might look this, at pH 3, short-term, you actually had some release of that bound P, but you're at pH 3, so you're actually probably dissolving the aluminum oxide itself. Under reducing conditions, this shows that under pretty severe reducing conditions, let me explain what is here. You have the soil only. The control soil is the yellow. Soil plus biosolids under reducing conditions, you actually get release of the phosphorus. But when aluminum water treatment residuals are included, effectively the water treatment residual prohibits the release of phosphorus under anaerobic conditions. Now realize, of course, these are aluminum water treatment residuals, and aluminum, there's not any redox chemistry associated with aluminum in contrast to iron. So there is the concern that iron 3, a reductive dissolution of iron oxides might release the phosphorus, but the limited amount of studies I've seen indicate that the iron is, in fact, is reduced to iron 2 and released, but the phosphorus isn't, doesn't come back out into solution. So that's something that needs to be more clearly elucidated. So just wanted to point out there that you get a dramatic reduction in the phosphorus release. Some of the other concerns for adding large concentrations of aluminum material to the soil, what's the impact? And so people are concerned about aluminum phytotoxicity or aluminum contamination of groundwater. I mean, intuitively, one would say, well, it really doesn't matter. I mean, the amount of aluminum you put on is pretty insignificant compared to the aluminum that's there naturally. I mean, aluminum is the most abundant metal in the Earth's crust, so what's the difference about adding a little bit more? The key is that freshly precipitated aluminum hydroxide should theoretically be more soluble than crystalline aluminum hydroxide. It's very hard to actually demonstrate that, and it apparently converts very quickly And so you can't really see an increased solubility, because we would guess that, gee, if you're near neutral pH, aluminum is not going to be very soluble. And studies tend to bear this out. This is a field study showing that, this is Bahia grass, showing that whether you have the aluminum water treatment residuals in the soil or not, you really don't get any change in the uptake of aluminum. And similarly for aluminum leaching to groundwater, if it's near neutral pH, you just don't have a problem with aluminum. And even incidentally on the previous slide with the plant uptake study, the pH was 5 or 5.5 of the soil. So even unless you get well below 5, you're not going to have a problem with increased soluble aluminum in plants. A grazing study was done, pretty high water treatment residual application rates, no effect on the liver, bone, or plasma in the animals, and no effect on their growth and development. Some of the regulatory barriers, most states probably have no regulatory pigeonhole for water treatment residuals. And often they tend to get thrown into the biosolids regulations. The problem is many biosolids statutes say that the material has to have some agronomic value, and you have to be creative at times to point out the agronomic value of land application of WTRs. Most state P indices probably have no explicit way of crediting the use of WTRs for reducing P loss potential. Now, in Pennsylvania, we have a P source coefficient that you can actually test in the lab, so you could blend the material and show that the water treatment residuals reduce the source coefficient, and therefore the P index does account for it. Some P indices have a certain number of credits for BMPs, so you may be able to get credit in those states, but in most cases, it's pretty hard for the P index to sort of credit the use of water treatment residuals. Another issue, stringent soil cleanup standards. Arsenic loading can sometimes exceed established soil cleanup levels. This is just a theoretical calculation based on a water treatment residual with a fairly typical arsenic concentration. They tend to be sort of 10 milligrams per kilogram. But the issue is that you can dream up some scenarios where, say, it's confined to the top centimeter and you're putting on a reasonable rate, 2.5%. And you actually end up exceeding the arsenic limit in Florida. That's a residual exposure sort of cleanup standard. Now, most soils in the U.S. have higher arsenic than that naturally background. So this is just an issue that in some states may be a concern. So the lessons learned, know the water treatment residual characteristics, particularly oxalate extractable iron or aluminum. Ensure adequate contact opportunity in the way that you're using them. I would say induced crop P deficiency is probably unlikely in field situations, at least if the loading rates are reasonable. In our state, in Pennsylvania, we can only put on 15 dry tons per acre, and so you're not going to find typically induced crop P deficiency under those conditions. Focus on the hot spots, because there may not be enough water treatment residual nearby to do what you want to do over, say, a large field area. And finally, at times, I think we need to educate the regulators, because they may not be familiar with water treatment residuals. So in closing, let me just mention a quote from the literature. Based on current understanding, there's minimal health and environmental risks associated with properly managed application of WTRs to soils. Current there was 1990. And I would say this conclusion is still valid even after a couple decades of research. Besides, WTRs are useful for immobilizing phosphorus. So that concludes my presentation, and I thank you for your attention, and we will try to answer your questions.
Thanks a lot, Chip, for that great presentation. We have time, plenty of time for questions. So.
Phil?
Beautiful talk.
Thank you.
I'd like to get a copy of the facts. In fact, I probably don't even need to give my talk.
That's what we were going to tell you.
I have a question. I don't think that anybody here thinks that aluminum solubility in the soil you do apply it, sometimes it's real sticky, and on forages, it will stick to forages, and the cows graze forages, or people may be cutting hay for forages. And so does Florida or any other state have time limits between the time of application until a hay cutting, or between time of application until cattle can be grazed?
George, you want to answer that? I don't know that. Hey, you go ahead.
The direct answer is no, we don't have time limits. But as a result of our work, following the example of Australian scientists, we recommend that only aged material, that age tends to allow the material to populate and become a whole lot easier and better to handle. Almost all the work we did was with dried materials, just thrown up in piles, allowed to heat water. It actually granulates very nicely. But to address the concern, we, besides the grazing study that we did, we also did sheep studies where we, shall we say, encouraged sheep to eat up to 15% of their diet as pure aluminum WTR. Of course, there was no effect. Now, if we gave it aluminum chloride,
okay, good. I just want to point out that Phil has mentioned the fact that really the rheology and nature of these materials can be very variable depending on how they're stored, how old they are, whether you're going to use them immediately. Freshly precipitated can be this sort of gelatinous goo that's really hard to handle. In the north, if they go through freeze thawing in the winter, it granulates them beautifully. Some materials dry rock hard and you have a hard time dealing with them. So that's just another caution that the nature of the materials can also be very variable. Nick?
Chip, I also like this is the best presentation I've seen at the meeting.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think the one comment I'm going to make is people will get a WTR and they'll say, can I use this material? They'll look for the oxalate extractable test, and they won't find it.
Right.
So I'll put a shameless plug. Ohio State, we do iron, aluminum, and iron oxide. So if you have a material that you think will fit, send it to us. We'll analyze it. Because some of these materials don't have enough aluminum in them to be a good absorbent, and they go in the topsoil category. Right?
Okay.
But if they have a lot of aluminum in them, so we will characterize the material for you if you have a candidate. And the arsenic, I mean, this is just a scary arson. It's across the whole country. We're worried about incredibly small amounts of background levels. But there are cases where you run up to 300, 200 parts of the animals. It's unusual levels.
Okay.
But it's a rare thing. You know, it's one of these folk questions. People have heard about that number. And they think all of it's here in the world.
Okay, thanks, Nick. Just for the purposes of the recording, Nick was pointing out the fact that oxalate extractable iron aluminum is not a routine soil test, and Ohio State will do that test. And also the fact that at times you can have high arsenic. Realizing that water treatment residuals often just reflect largely the sediment that's in the water source. So if your soil happens to be high or the background, from a background standpoint, that's going to be in your water treatment residual. So some water treatment residuals don't have much aluminum. That's the other thing you pointed out. Sometimes we have what's called direct filtration plants that really hardly generate any water treatment residual. They're just putting a little bit of alum in. And so you have some that aren't really useful for piezorbing, and so you really need to run that test. Yes?
Well water. If you get well water, drinking water from the well, like on the eastern shore where you have sandstone, pea body, the water treatment residual is much higher than what's usually there. I've seen it pretty high pea body in the water treatment residual as a result of the well water that the city uses to drink the water.
That's interesting. Couple of comments. Most groundwaters are used without sort of extensive treatment, like was shown here. That what I showed you for the typical process is surface water. But again, it points out that some water treatment residuals have nitrogen or phosphorus levels that can't be ignored in a land application program. Thank you.
I'll take one more question.
Rufus.
I've heard of rare WTRs that had radium, one in Wisconsin, one in the Northeast, but there was enough radium in the, that it may be inappropriate for use. Did you kind of sort that out at all? Any other rare cases that need to be evaluated?
In terms of radioactivity or?
In terms of risk that is not commonly found.
Yeah, again, I guess you could have high trace elements depending on the background geology. You know, I think, you know, the sewage sludge survey, even there we found that usually most of them don't have a radioactivity problem. But clearly, if you're in an area that has high background radioactivity or high trace elements, you need to be concerned, because, or at least you need to, there needs to be a word of caution that you make sure you look for those things in the water treatment residual.
Thanks, Chip.